Yes.
All my life, and that is for 43 years, I've been holding strictly to the principle that you should not partake of sentient flesh of any kind or any poison of any kind. And I, for that reason, I have felt that you are doing a wonderful work, but I cannot understand why you draw the line on eggs. I might know.
This is Mr. Hackett?
Hackley.
Yes, that's all right. Sit down, please. About the eggs, you see, we are to use such like diet which is helping sexually, you see. We want to control our passions. Anything that goes to flare up passions, those are to be avoided.
I see, and eggs, they certainly do.
Yes.
I understand.
For that reason, you see.
I'm saying,
because you have to go to a refined state, you want to find that even more eating.
Isn't there another reason too? Don't they have something called chlorophyll or something in them?
Maybe I don't know.
Why?
Main thing is like that, you see. One way we want to put down fire, the other we say enough for the even simple diet, you see. Even more diet is there, you see. Just fill your belly from double to the gullet. Oh, that also said.
In other words, I have understood that several people didn't
eat eggs, but
I never knew the exact reason. But I have heard about them being very conducive to.
Sure. But I tell you, there are no equivalent diets in the dietary system, too. I'll give you a small prescription. Half of walnut.
Long.
Two almonds. And munakili generally?
Raisin
is small one.
Like
raisins it is, but black
grapes
dry. That is called munaka that time. Grapes? Currants. Four currants, two almonds, and half walnut will give you the same for two eggs.
Let's see now, one walnut, two almonds,
yes.
And a currant or
yes.
Raisin or something.
That will give you two, that
right.
Even that, more than that.
That will give you the same nourishment that the egg would give you.
Yes, sir.
I wish you would please give me your address before you leave,
I'll
mail you some information.
Where do you live?
I live at 4223 Southern Parkway.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm very glad to see you all here, you see, gathered together. Yes, half walnut.
Half a walnut, two almonds, one currant.
No, four currants. Four. Four currants, two almonds, half walnut.
Half walnut.
Well, the walnut is
thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hackley.
And then, Paul,
I'm going to get
the four
currents. Here. Yes. Dr. Huber Freeman from Dallas is holding up a hand.
Yes.
I'd like to understand why you do not have them stop smoking, eating tobacco, when you have them stop eating food. It's very harmful to the body.
We do stop them from smoking as soon as we can.
I mean, why do you demand that immediately like you do the others?
All intoxicants, the word I use, all intoxicants. Smoking also intoxicants. Because when they're going to murder a man, they will smoke and then if it, they kill others.
I know, but you don't require them to stop smoking.
I always stop it, please.
Yeah.
I always stop it, in India and everywhere. I say all intoxicants.
Well, they haven't stopped.
You know, no, stop, that's another thing. But I don't.
You don't require it of them.
No, there's no question of driving. You see, it contains nicotine, you see. And if you want to continue, that also gives a fit.
Pardon me just a moment. Dr. Freeman, if they're smoking, they're not barred from initiation.
That's what I mean.
And but I think under the new ruling, they are, aren't they?
What?
Do they have to stop smoking before they can be initiated?
In talks, yes, I do in India.
Yeah.
Our master also said,
well, we're starting it here.
300 or so many diseases only arise from smoking. 360 or so. Bad habit too, but still, it is a bad effect and gives intoxication too, it's intoxicating. And you'll find whenever a man is going to murder, he first have a smoke, and in that particular way. Then you find language. Then if you fit, that's an injury, that's it, eh? False recovery. That's it.
You know the room I was referring to, didn't you?
Make what?
I said, maybe you know some of our leaders smoke.
Pop smoke.
There are somebody who did. Don't even say those who are leaders, they become perfect. They are on the way, all imperfect people. We have to carry and work with them. But they must stop. There's no reason why they should not. If their leaders dare not be, they just act like a bad example. You're right there.
Because in our home is a big sign, no smoking.
Yes, but we didn't do that in the beginning, did we?
Always. In India, at least.
Always.
Yes. Nobody allowed to sit sang or anywhere, no smoking. Even others who come who are not in here, they're not, also not allowed.
Yeah, not nobody in the ashram, nobody, you know.
Yes. Even though they're addicted to it, and they are.
They don't understand.
They're understanding.
I think that should be made clear to them if not. That's all. If I speak to
you. I'll let you tell them.
Yes,
you
yes.
Don't tell.
Intoxicants include, you see, smoking. Yes, I tell you one thing. Intoxicants, you see, for wines, etc., they affect all at once. This affects slowly, but that injures. In the long run, it is a side of a doctor, that 360 or so many diseases arise only by smoking.
But you
see,
religion is strictly forbidden to smoke.
See, everybody, almost everybody in the...
Yes.
In
what the is bad is bad kind of good, you see. Those who are addicted to that, they simply make little allowances. That's how to meet with their own purpose. This is bad. Not correct, yes.
In the Path of the Masters, Dr. Johnson wrote that if we were smoking at the time of initiation, the time would come when God would give us something to take the place of the smoking.
Not that it's prohibited everywhere. They take it, that's another thing. But there are so many things prescribed and the people don't do it. They should.
It's a fine. You touch it.
Are there any other questions?
Participate in Matthew, Rosh Krishna, plus the other things he told us. The almost, the day, the snake, and the gross spiritually.
Oh, yes.
What?
Do almonds make you grow strong?
Yeah, they're sacred. What do they do? They don't create any other thing. It is helping right now. Helping. Yeah. All nuts. They're proteins. Yeah.
Any others? What about you, Elsie? Leon?
Maharaji, what can we do, or what must we do in order to increase in us the feeling of love, which is the...
I think I replied to you last night about this.
Oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't here then.
Oh, That is regularly recorded, last thing, I think. That is recorded. I just gave it.
You get it from Jack
Hole. Love is already ingrained in you. Simply with love from outside in you. Let it run far in the company of those who have got love. This comes by religion. And the more you come in contact with the light and sound principle, that is love personified, you see. The more you come in touch with that, the love in you will flare up. And the outward company of those who are lovers of God, that will give you very great impact.
Any more?
Yes, please.
Yes. When you say no drugs, does that also mean no medications that are prescribed sometimes by physicians?
I never said anything about drugs.
I thought that said that on the initiation paper.
That's what?
I thought I read that on the paper, from the application, no drugs.
No drugs mean intoxicating drugs, not the treatment.
Not but
medicines would be all right. Medicines, you see, that is only to help you. Naturally, nowadays, people are coming around to appreciate the natural healing. I mean, natural way of healing by vegetables and other things. But anyhow, if that is required, that is only medicine do little or nothing, I tell you. It is the soul that has the curative power. We simply clear the way to help the soul.
Miss Smith, do you want to ask him some?
He's answered
everything I want to know. Yes? That's John Young.
I was with a master the other day at Mr. Connell's blind school.
Yes.
Said there was homeopathic medicine you can take to stop smoking in 3 days.
Yeah, that is criteria for us, they say. Criteria for
3X.
Aversion, that comes from aversion, like aversion for smoking. Criteria for us, 3X, put it in a glass of water and sip it, say, every 5 minutes, for 2 hours or so.
That will cure you from smoking?
That will give you aversion to smoking.
Aversion.
Aversion. Hate it. You won't like to smoke. Yes. Like what? Criteria fast 3X. 3X is the potency. 3X. X, not X. X is the potency, you see? Oh, homeopathy doctor. You can get from homeopathy.
What is it all?
It is calcium, you see. Calcium and phosphorus. Combined 3X.
Calcium and phosphorus.
Calcium.
Calcium.
Calcium and phosphorus. 3X. You got it at a homeopathic drug.
It is prepared. Already, yes.
Where do you get a homeopathic
drugstore? Isn't there one here?
No.
Yes, there is. Somebody told me that he's getting his wife treated by a homeopath. Somebody told me the other day. Everywhere in
homeopathic in Louisville?
No, somebody told me here that he's getting his wife treated by a homeopathic. So much.
All right. If he's here, I'll find him. Now, you want to give... No, wait. See what the...
What is the dose?
See what the young man wants.
What is the dose? 3 teaspoons
in a glass of water?
It is 3 teaspoons in a glass of water. 3 teaspoons
in a glass of water.
Oh, no. Those are tablets, you see. Prepare, you put it 8-10 tablets in a glass of water, you see. And then have with a small spoonful, take every 5 minutes. 1 spoon, 2 spoon, like that.
This is a young man staying
here. Yes, please.
Are we supposed to tell the new applicants for initiation to stop smoking before their exemption?
Well, yes, they should. That is, I tell you one thing. Some are such like things which give instantaneous, they affect very quickly. Smoking affects later, but it is to be stopped. they should stop.
Now, do you wish to give your message?
Should I? What message do I have to give?
I'll give your talk then.
Well, he said, you know, Christ once said to his disciples, I don't want to make you slaves, but as friends. Slaves do not know what a friend could be. Slaves only know just do what he said. Friends, you see, you can appreciate anybody if you just work along with him, see what he's doing. You look like a sweeper going by that road. So Christ said, I make you my friends. So I think it is better I address you as friends. Because I've told you many times that I'm a man like you, with the same privileges that you have got from God. But in a way, I have dwelt in a certain way, you have not. And that dwellment is due to the grace of God or the God working through my master. That is how to die while alive, how to be reborn, how to be cut off from the attachments of the world, body and other things. That's the way it is within you already. So, I love you as friends, I would say. I regard you as the children of light. Because I love God, and that light is everywhere, so I have to love you and have regard to you as well. So my point is, you see, I would like to bring to your notice specially, the initiation does not mean that you become perfect. That is the way to perfection. One does not become a satsangi simply by being initiated. Satsangi word means, sat means unchangeable permanence, and sangi means who is in contact with it constant. We have been put on the way just to analyze our soul, our mind and outward faculties, and have some touch, contact with God power. When you remain a constant companion of that God power, then only you become a true satsangi. Now you have been. I have got something, of course, to start with, how to contact. But unless you begin to be conscious of that power all through, you are not a true satsangi. So, we have to mold our lives in accordance with the principles of satsang in thought, speech, and action. Simply you take medicine and put it in the shelf. Would you? Your disease will go. So, all masters say, those who live up to what they are told, and they are just saying that he is my master and I am his slave. Let's see, a father has 4 or 5 children. Some children just obey him, others do not. And some children, even not by obedience, he surrenders to the will of his father. Well, father is thus, as I told you yesterday, when you surrender, he becomes your slave. If you have got a son, very obedient, he just works up to your intentions. He never asks for anything. I think what the father does, when he leaves, he simply hands over the key to that son. Not to everybody. He says, well, all right, look to the interest of others. Don't let others not starve. So similarly, those who live up to what they are told, that is what is required. Mere obedience, first of all, love requires. If you love me, keep my commandments, as I told you yesterday. We don't keep up commandments. Some do with some modifications, we suit their own interests. Unless we live up to 100% what the Master says, we cannot truly to know what is God. So actions speak louder than words, and thoughts are even more potent. A sangha must lead a daily conduct, must reveal what he is, not what he says, but what he is. You say, love all and see whether he loves all. If he loves all, whether he is always ready to help others without any show. If he still loves, is he ready to sacrifice his everything for him? So not only everybody can know so much about these things, you see. Libraries are full of them. Scriptures are full of them. You see, just what you say, loading an ass with books. What is it now? If you paddle, you see, on the spoon moves in a sweet dish, do you mean that thing, taste anything out of that? To know so many things in your brain will do you little or no good, and perhaps will do more evil than good. Because you act in power, why know so much? But you don't live up to it. The main thing is we must live. And live not willingly, you see. But with joy and love and devotion. So, obedience comes next. And obedience also is not sufficient, we should surrender. This is what is needed. And all masters have been saying like that. If one of you people just find some shortcoming in you, what do they say? A satsang is like that. Like a master teaches that way. Some people have been writing to me on account of some shortcomings here and there. I always reply to them, pity it is that I have to carry on with imperfect people. They are all not perfect. They are all on the way to perfection. Those who are on the way to perfection here, that they do. Wow. So just forgive and forget, and we should be on the way for the common cause of God. So that is why what is needed. Live up to what is needed. Truth is above all. But true living is still about truth. People don't know whether you can have contact with Him, with the light of God or not. They'll see how you live, how you behave, what your treatment with others. Are you fighting with others for selfish motives? Are you just usurping others' rights? Are you just sucking the blood of others? They'll see you from that level. If your life, you see, is above. If this glass is besmeared with silk, light is there, but that won't give up light. So bulb should be quite clean, without any dust. So our hearts must be what we have got in the heart, that should be at our mouth. And what is at our mouth, that should agree with our thoughts. When these three agree, there is agreement between the three, consider it is right. Sometimes we do one thing for many days, that becomes habit. Habit turns into nature. It's very difficult to remove that habit. That nature which has formed becomes our nature. So first of all, what to do? I would say perform no action in secret. Chaitanya Noda, you'll find everything very helpful. Right? Perform no action in secret. If anything requires secrecy, abandon it at once. Deeds of darkness are committed in the dark. Mind that. This is first, that's the criterion of a sin. You want secrecy. That's considered in all our ways of life. Then, further, do nothing which after being done lead you to tell lies. That's also criterion for something wrong, you see. To do one sin that followed by lying, because you want to complete it, you see. I tell you, the criterion of a saint is one. You find him everywhere like that, in or out, at midnight or daytime, at the pulpit or in his private rooms. Half a saint, when we go to the pulpits, we give very long yarns of talks. But when they go to the secret, they do otherwise. Well, mind that. God is in between you, and God power, also the God in man, also watches everything. How can you deceive him? You can deceive others. Our master used to say, if a child is sitting, or 5 years old is sitting, you won't do anything unbecoming in his presence. You require secrecy. When you think the master, when he gives initiation, that God power just takes possession of you within, he looks to the very thoughts that arise, he knows the very trend you are following, then how can you deceive him? So I always say, be true to your own self. So if you are true to your own self, how can you deceive others, you see? So, this is the main criterion, you see. And further, don't desire evil for anyone, irrespective of creed or color, even in thought. That's the next to come. Anyone, not necessarily your initial brother, you see. Anyone. Because whatever thought arises there, you see, that poisons you. Others don't know, but you have been poisoned. And by radiation you will find thoughts are more potent. I gave you, I think the other day, the example of Akbar the Great, the king, great king of India. Birbal was his minister. He told him whatever a man thinks about anybody, that reacts in others' minds. He said, how can that be proved? So the minister took him away to some place or roadside. One man was coming at a distance and told the king, just think anything about him in your mind. The king was going bareheaded, you see. He thought about that when coming, I should shoot him in his mind. When he came by, he passed by him, he said, well, look here, tell me truly, I forgive you. What did it strike to you when you saw my face? He said, I thought with the face I should break your head. That reaction. Never think evil of others. These are the things we think evil of others, my God. When we say anything against anybody, what is it? It is thinking evil of others. When we backbite, what do? We think evil of others. When we make parties with one or the other, what do? We tell them that this side something, that side something. You deceive your own self. And the God in you sees you. That was I may mention to you today, once. There's all those controversies going on, just go on in my life.
Good morning. Welcome to the Satsang of Master Kripal Singh. The recording you just heard was the first part of a question and answer session and a talk given by Master on 14th November 1963 in Louisville, Kentucky. The talk was titled, What is a True Satsangi? Our reader this morning is Rudy Cascon. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, Pradeep. Thank you. Today I'll be reading from Master's book, The Mystery of Death, Chapter 4, Death in Bondage, starting on page 65, the very, very bottom of the page, with the quote from the great philosopher-poet William Wordsworth. This can be accessed from Form 2007, the PDF file from the RuhaniSatsang.org website. And Master begins by saying, the great philosopher-poet William Wordsworth, 1777 to 1859, draws a beautiful pen picture of the growing child in his memorable ode on imitations of immortality from recollections of his early childhood. The soul that rises with us, our life star, hath elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar, not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness. But trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy. But he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he sees it in his joy. The youth, who daily father from the east, must travel, still is nature's priest. And by the vision splendid is on his way attended. At length a man perceives it die away and fade into the light of common day. Earth fills her lap with pleasures of her own, yearnings she hath in her own natural kind, and even with something of a mother's mind, and no unworthy aim. The homely nurse doth all she can to make her foster child, the inmate man, forget the glories he hath known, and that imperial palace whence he came. So this is the sordid picture of life on earth as we ourselves witness from day to day. Even having our fill as preordained, we are yet hungry, ravenously hungry for more and more pilf and power, more of ephemeral pleasures and sense enjoyments. Far from being thankful for what we have in the bounties of nature, we look before and after and pine for what is not. Nature cannot remain a silent spectator of our unappeased gluttony, and with her magic wand turns us, Circe-like, into swine, so that we may have our fill of the piffle and be done away with. It is only some wise Ulysses, armed with a magic flower from Mercury, the messenger of the gods, who can fight the enchantress on her own ground and rescue his followers, getting them reconverted from swine into men, and along with them all others held in captivity by the sorceress in many different forms, each according to his or her innate nature. It is the type of the ruling passions that determines our course of life, not only here right now in the living present, but also in the hereafter. Now let us have a look at the inevitable process of change called death. This transference from one state of life to another is a necessary adjunct of life and takes place in its own good time, but with a swift and stunning suddenness, and the more so when it is least expected. Death knows no calendar, and no one can predict it, nor can anyone escape from it with all his cunning and wit. Each living thing has its own allotted span of life. We all live, move, and have our being in time, and when the sands of time run out, this change comes, and continues to do so time and again, until one gets beyond the farthest bounds of time and arises into timelessness. Death, then, is something terribly real and unavoidable. It perhaps seems to be the only real thing in the midst of the unrealities of the world. Every rich or poor, king or beggar, young or old, healthy or diseased, has to pass through the trapdoor of death, whether one likes to do so or not. So one may live for long or short, for 100 years or just a while. One cannot live eternally on in one and the same life form, which in the course of time is sure to decay and become wearily burdensome, a milestone around the neck, as it were. And one in sheer desperation would cry out in anguish for the quick riddance from the heavy load hanging around the self in him. Neither kings nor beggars remain, all go, each one in his own time, Ram Kali M1. A Muslim dervish therefore advises, all thy life thou hast bemoaned the death of others, why not sit for a while and ponder over thy own fate? Is death a painful process? Is the next question. Generally speaking, it is so with most. The scriptures tell us of the excruciating pain that a dying person suffers at the time of death. In the Bhagavad Purana, it is said that one experiences the horror of death pangs as if one were bitten by 1,000,000 scorpions at once. In the Holy Quran, likens the throes of death to the condition of a person when a thorny hedge is pulled through the alimentary canal from one end to the other. The Sikh scriptures also speak in much the same strain. The life currents are wrenched out. All such statements are merely illustrative of the immensity of torture that one may experience when the demons of death appear to forcibly take the spirit out of the body. What actually happens at the time of death is only the dying man who knows. No one, after the actual experience of terminal death, has ever returned from across the borders of the death land to tell us of the exact nature of his final sufferings. Each one suffers unto himself and becomes silent forever. To be on the deathbed is a veritable nailing on the cross, and the death chamber is a charnel house. One can scarcely stand unmoved when some people toss restlessly for days on end with a death rattle in their throat, writhing in extreme agony on the deathbed. Who can assuage the tortures of death? All stand helplessly by. The best physicians, administering drugs to the last, the attendant nurses walking on tiptoes, the nearest kith and kin with tearful eyes, woe-begotten looks, and somber faces awaiting the inevitable end. Who hears the piteous cries of the poor victim and his companions, his wife and children? As the wife with hairs disheveled moans, the solitary spirit wings its way alone. Kabir. Of Alexander the Great, from 356 to 323 BC, king of Macedonia and conqueror of the world, as known that at the time, it is said that it had been prophesied that he would die only when the earth would be of steel and the sky of gold. As neither of these two phenomena were thought to be possible, the king was lulled into a false sense of perennial security. He imagined and believed that, like the Olympian gods, he was immortal. After long and wearisome campaigns in the Far East, as he was passing through a desert near Babylon on his way back to Greece, he was stricken with fever. Being unable to hold on to his saddle, he was helped to dismount. One of his generals spread his steel coat of mail on the ground, lined as it was with velvet on the inside, and made the king lie thereon, and held up outstretched the golden embroidered umbrella over the king's face to protect him from the scorching rays of the fierce desert sun. It was then that Alexander, the great hero of many a battle, the invincible conqueror, realized that his end was near, for he was now lying on the steely ground with a golden awning over him. He was overtaken by consternation. Addressing the best of his physicians who were attending upon him, he with tearful eyes begged that something should be done to save him for the time being, so that he could again reach home and meet his mother, whom he greatly loved. But one and all of them expressed their helplessness. He then offered them at first half of his kingdom and finally the whole of his kingdom if they could, by their medical skill, procure for him that much of a respite. But who could help to stay the divine decree? On the 10th day of his illness, as his generals one by one passed through the tented chamber of the dying king, Alexander bade them goodbye and directed that at his funeral, both of his hands should be kept out of the shroud, so that all could see that the great emperor was leaving empty-handed, in the same way he had come into the world. Well, similarly, we hear the sad story of a great and talented queen who ruled over vast dominions. She was adored by her people for her dazzling beauty and admired for her sagacity. She had ruled wisely and well for a long time. Brought up in the lap of luxury, with hundreds of attendants, she could not for a moment believe there was such a thing as death. When her end came, she was stricken with great sorrow and overtaken by poignant grief. The royal physicians by her bedside could do nothing to assuage her fears and torments. As death stared her in the face, her physicians tried to console her, and they advised her to prepare for the last journey. What? She in horror cried. And where was she going? She wondered. Alas, to the land from where there is no return, was the simple reply. She could not believe her ears. Am I dreaming? She inquired. No, you have to go, Your Majesty. Is there a land of no return? And if so, where is it? It is far off from this world, said her courtiers. Could you not locate it for me in time? And what preparations have you made make my stay over there comfortable? Asked the queen. None, Your Majesty. And how many will accompany me to that land? Inquired the terrified queen. You will have to go all alone and by yourself, madame, said the courtiers. And how many attendants will be permitted to take? I will be permitted to take with me? None, not one. Such indeed is our ignorance of the realities of life. We are clever, very clever, in the workaday affairs of the world. But strange as it may seem, we know next to nothing of the stern retribution that awaits all of us. And we have, like all others, to go alone and empty-handed. Naked I came into the world, and naked shall I go. See Ecclesiastes 5:15. That indeed is the inevitable fate of all. Weeping we come into the world, and weeping we depart from the world. To come weeping is understandable. A newborn babe does weep as he emerges from the chamber of the womb, for he is severed from the light of life that has been sustaining him right through the period of gestation, in that chamber suspended upside down. This is why we generally keep some sort of light on for the first few nights after the birth of the child. Whenever he cries, we turn his face towards that light, or sometimes we play the rattle to amuse the baby and quiet him. But why should we weep at the time of departure when on the way back to our parental care of the loving father? It was open to us to relink the strands of life in us by consciously working for that end. Thus, willy-nilly, we do not care to do, and the human existence from cradle to the grave runs by as a waste. Once this opportunity is lost, we go down in the scale of existence. To fall from the top rung of the ladder more often than not proves fatal. Snapping the ties which acquired relationships of the world spread over a number of years is painful, and the departure is terrifically poignant, the more so as we are quite unprepared for the quit notice that is sprung upon us. We do not know how to quit the rented house and where to go. The prospect of being thrown out into the unknown as we take our life after death to be bewilders us. All of this serves to work up a state of horror, unimaginable horror of the worst type. That is why it is said, remember thou the day you came weeping into the world to the jubilation of all those around thee. Live thou such a life that you may depart laughing amidst the weeping and wailing of all. Francis Quarles, 1592 to 1644, a mystic poet, speaking of death, tells us, if thou expect death as a friend, prepare to entertain it. If thou expect death as an enemy, prepare to overcome it. Death has no advantage but when it comes a stranger. Well, herein lies the difference between the Eastern and Western thought of death on death. St. Paul, describing death as the last enemy of man, said, I die daily, in the Corinthians 5:31. And then St. Paul mockingly asked, O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? Corinthians 15:55. The Eastern savants hailed death as an occasion for union with the beloved. The conclusion, however, is the same in both cases, that death claims an advantage over us only when it comes suddenly and swiftly as an unexpected stranger, neither as an expected friend nor as a dreaded foe. But when we are entirely unprepared to receive it or meet its challenge. Those who are prepared for death and are ever ready receive it and welcome it, taking it as a homegoing, a means to achieve union with the beloved. A true lover of God, even when condemned to death for heresy, cheerfully lays his head on the block and beseechingly calls for the executioner, praying that he make a short shrift of his body with his sword, as he sees reflected in it the light of his beloved God. After all, what is death? Death is a debt we must all pay, Euripides. This being the case, why not pay off the debt and be forever free from the obligation? The body is the ransom or the dowry which the soul has to deliver to obtain ultimate release from the law of retribution. To have some idea of what happens after death, let us have recourse to the scriptural text. The Master divides mankind into four categories. In the first group, there are those who have not had the good fortune to take refuge with any Sant Satguru, and these form a considerable bulk. They have to go all alone, each a solitary soul by itself, without any friend or companion. All such souls have to appear before and abide by the decree of the God of justice, Dharam Raj, who dispenses stern and strict justice on the principle of as you sow, so shall you reap. See Galatians 6:7. Without compassion or commiseration. This is what is called the inexorable law of karma, which works endlessly. This law does not take into account any extraneous circumstances and emits of no exceptions. Castes, social classes, and color avail naught there. One gets his meed or reward according to his deeds. Asa M3. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts and minds. Proverbs 21:2. At the appointed time of which no one is aware, good angels, Ramgans, or bad angels, Yamgans, as the case may be, come to take the spirit forcibly out of the body, and one has to go along with them. They escort the spirit to the judgment seat, and each spirit has to render account of his thoughts, words, and deeds. Thomas Carlyle says, "Fool, thinkest thou that because no Boswell is there to take note thy jargon, it is therefore dies, is buried. Nothing dies, nothing can die. The idlest word thou speakest is a seed cast into time, which brings fruit to all eternity." Jesus, in no uncertain term, has declared, "And I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof on the day of judgment. For by the words thou shalt be justified, made even, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned." St. Matthew 12:36-7. Although thoughts, feelings, and emotions, all words uttered intentionally or unintentionally, and all deeds done premeditatedly or casually, leave indelible impressions, sanskaras, or nishai amal, on the tablet of the mind, and the account has to be rendered after death. It is all a summary procedure, but just, with no provisions for logic, chopping, or argument, or appeal to any higher power, nor can there be any chance of release therefrom. The one who has indulged all his life in sinful doings is sent to hell, narak or dozak, to undergo the penal servitude for a particular length of time, as his misdeeds may merit, and thereby rid himself of the evil impressions and understand the law that works for his ultimate good. When the allotted time expires, the soul once again takes birth so that it may have another chance to lead a reformed life, freed from the evil now washed off, and make a fresh start, avoiding the pitfalls of the past. If one leads a life of righteousness, he is assigned a place in heaven or paradise, swag, baikunith, or baishist, where he, for some allotted time interval, enjoys the fruits of his good deeds, after which he too once again comes down to the earth plane. And thus all souls ensconced in the comic wheel of life move up and down by the ceaseless momentum of their own deeds. There is no escape from this ever-revolving giant wheel until one, by the stroke of good fortune, meets some Satguru, and the latter accepts him and helps him to the way out and to the God way. The spirits, upon coming out of the nether world of Pluto, gradually work their way up from the minerals to the vegetable kingdom, and then to the world of insects and reptiles, and on to that of the feathery fraternity, and next to quadrupeds, and finally to human beings. After passing through the wheel of 84, thou hast gained the top. O Nanak, now take hold of the power of God. Be thou eternally free. Shir Agrag, my M5. Even the devas or deities, the various gods and goddesses who were said to reign in regions of bliss, are there on account of their highly meritorious deeds on the lower planes. As soon as they exhaust the merit gained, they have also to return to the physical world. The blessed Lord Krishna, the adorable one, once explaining to Uddhav, a devoted disciple of his, pointed to an insect crawling in the filth, and said, "O Uddhav, this insect that you see before you has oftentimes been Indra, the god of thunder and rain, and has oftentimes been groveling in the dirt as at present. Such indeed is the fate of all." Even the avatars, the incarnations, the embodiments of the powers of God, are not immune from the inflexible working of the karmic wheel and are also called to judgment. Like a soldier in the army, the avatar is not immune from liability under the civil law. In addition to his obligations under the military law governing his profession, even if he may doing his duty under the command of his superiors, which is law unto him under military regulations, he may incur a civil liability under the civil law. His is a twofold responsibility, one under the army law, to wit, to obey implicitly what the officers order him to do on pain of being court-martialed if he disobeys, and the other, under the civil administration, if in the discharge of his duties he is found to have exceeded the limits of his military orders. Gods and goddesses and the incarnations of various powers of God are therefore included in this category, so far as the law of karma extends. With all of their privileged position, they, including the entire host of angels, are under the law and not above the law. This is why they too seek human birth, in which lies the possibility of escape from the toils and struggles onward to the abode of peace eternal, life everlasting. Even the great rishis, with all their austerities and penances, when the end of their allotted time draws nigh, wish to aspire to for a human body in preference to celestial abodes in heaven as the shining ones, the devas. The rishis do so because it is this way alone that they stand a chance of contacting a Satguru, receiving instructions from him, and then rising above the inexorable law of causation or action and reaction. Heroes like Arjuna and the Pandava brothers accept Yudhishthira, the Dharmaputra, the embodiment of Dharma, as he was commonly known and believed to be, were cast into the nether regions for engaging in a war, even though the war was righteous and enjoined by no less a personage than the blessed Lord Krishna himself, because in doing so they could not, with all their exhortations from Lord Krishna, divest themselves of the idea of doership. Again, Lord Krishna himself, it is said that he met his death by the chance arrow shot by a bill, a hunter, thus requiting his past karma committed ages before, as Rama, who had killed the invincible Bali, a forest prince, by the artifice of shooting an arrow from behind the cover of a tree. Rama and Krishna, it may be mentioned, both incarnations of Lord Vishnu in different ages. Similarly, of King Dhrashtra, the father of Rama, it is said that one night while hunting in the forest, he heard a gurgling sound that seemed to come to him to be that of some wild animal lapping water close by among the rushes and reeds. Guided by the sound, he aimed his arrow in that direction, hitting a young man, Sarvan by name, who had gone to the riverside to obtain water in a pitcher for a pannier on his back, and who had just left his blind and thirsty parents some distance away. Well, hearing the piteous and anguished cry of his victim, the king rushed toward the dying man, who told him of his plight and begged him to take the water to his parents. Full of grief, the king took the water to the aged couple and told them of the mishap. They could hardly bear the shock and died, bemoaning their lot, wishing the same fate for their unknown perpetrator of the crime. In the course of time, the king also met the same fate when he died in bitter agony caused by the pangs of separation from his son Rama, who had been exiled for 14 long years. And this is how nemesis overtakes each one in his turn, meting out what is due unto him. Thus each one comes into the world and goes out of it into the valley of death under the compulsive force of karma. In the second category of mankind fall all persons who come in contact with a living, perfect master, accepted by him, and initiated into the esoteric science of the soul, but for one reason or another are not able to develop communion with the Holy Word to any appreciable extent, be it on account of indulgence, insults, pleasures, sense for, or lethargy, or something else. They stand on a different footing from those of the first category. At the time of death of these initiates, when the soul currents begin to withdraw from the body, or a little earlier, the Satguru in his radiant form appears within to take charge of the departing spirit. The radiant form of the master gladdens the heart of the devotees, and he gets so absorbed in him that all attachments of the world fall off like autumn leaves. And then he fearlessly, joyously follows him into the valley of the shadow of death. And I'll stop right there. As I was reading from The Mystery of Death, Chapter 4, Death and Bondage, starting on page 65. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, Master, for letting us be here, and appreciate all your loving words. Amen.
And thank you, Rudy, for reading for us. There were 85 of us listening to today's satsang. Thank you, everyone, for your listening. And thank you, Master, for providing this for us.
So we have to learn swimming in water, or on the dry land. We have to be in the world, yet out of it. And to achieve that success is to be self-centered. You follow my point?